Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers, and $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
A woman leaves home to do some shopping on Fifth Avenue in New York City before vanishing in broad daylight. When news broke of socialite Dorothy Arnold's disappearance in 1911, nearly 6 weeks had already passed. Her family said that they were going to the press as their last resort after using private detectives to search for their daughter. But this news coverage unearthed secrets the family likely didn't want to share. A secret relationship with an older man, clandestine meetings in other cities, the possibility that Dorothy had been unhappy with her life at home. Could these secrets provide clues to what happened to Dorothy the day she disappeared? This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we will be joined by guest reader Sharon Lawrence.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
For today, I was wondering how you felt about some of the older cases that we've covered.
Like how old?
Well, you know, we covered Beverly Sharpman. That was like 1947. I think that's the oldest that we've done so far.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's going to sound strange, but like in a way, I almost feel like they're more comfortable to talk about because they're so far in the past. Where some of the current cases we're talking about, like those women are currently missing or, you know, I feel like those people are currently in danger. And that makes me feel a little bit more uncomfortable and a little bit more anxious talking about them. Where some of the older cases, it feels like we're talking about something not even from our time. So it doesn't, I guess maybe it doesn't feel as real to me, even though it is definitely a very real topic, you know?
Right. So that's like time distance.
Yeah. Right? Like I get, like I have like a little bit of a detachment from just because of the time. And I think that helps me be a little less anxious about our conversations.
Okay. Yeah. And today is the oldest case from my poetry collection, Doe. I don't know in the future if we're going to cover an older case than this one, but this one is from 1910. So whatever has happened has happened.
Okay.
So we are going way back in time and we're going to New York City for this story. And I want to preface this with saying that I have actually seen this story covered contemporarily in a few different ways. And some of our coverage is going to be a little bit different. And some of the details might be different, largely because when I was going through like the actual accounts from that time period, some of the stuff that I see later replicated isn't exactly what was going down at the time, or at least from the information that I found about this case. So I just wanted to say that to sort of preface this in case anyone's familiar with this story.
Okay.
So on January 25th, 1911, Francis R. Arnold, who was a wealthy perfume importer, gathered New York City journalists for a press conference about his missing daughter, 25-year-old Dorothy Harriet Camille Arnold. The facts he gave were as follows, that on December 12th, 1910, his daughter went missing.
Wait, okay, so she went missing on December 12th. And he didn't report her missing until January 25th?
He does not tell the press until January 25th, so.
So has he reported her missing at all in that time frame?
Kind of a little and kind of not. Yeah, so this is 6 weeks after she's disappeared.
Right.
Yeah, so Dorothy, what he tells people is that Dorothy left home on her own to go to look at some dresses. She left their house at 108 East 79th Street in New York City at approximately 11:30 a.m. and arrived at Park and Tilford's on Fifth Avenue at around noon, where she purchased about a half a pound of candies. My kind of girl.
This is kind of adorable. So she's shopping for dresses and buying candy and
yeah,
she's just out.
Yeah, when I was actually researching this, I was like, I want some candies.
This is right. And okay. What kind of cute candies would it have been?
Apparently she liked chocolate.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. From there, she went and took a bus to Brentano's bookstore on 27th and 5th, getting there between 1:30 and 2. While she was there, she purchased a book, Emily Calvin Blake's Engaged Girl Sketches, which was recently published collection of short stories about women experiencing engagements, sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad. And after she made her purchase, she left the store and simply vanished.
Sounds like she was having a very good day before she vanished.
I mean, if you asked me to define, like, my good day, it would be getting a book, eating some candy, shopping. Yeah. During the press conference, her father says that he engaged the help of private investigators, lawyers, and eventually Pinkertons to look for his daughter, and now, when they've exhausted all leads, he's coming to the public and to New York City police in the hopes that something will be uncovered that they haven't found so far.
So what's a Pinkerton? I'm not familiar with that.
So they were formed in about, like, the mid-1800s, and it's, like, considered, like, kind of like a private investigator security-type firm kind of thing. A lot of people would recognize them as they were hired very often to be, like, strike breakers back in the, you know, that era, the industrialist era. So they were useful but also problematic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Her father, during this press conference, he addresses some obvious questions that you might have. He says that they have been in touch with her friends, but none of them have knowledge of her whereabouts. He also says that she is not in any romantic relationships, but that there were three men in her acquaintance. Two were in the city, but had alibis for their time the day she went missing, and the third was away in Italy with his parents, so that was not a lead either. He also says that the private investigators have discovered thus far amounts to very little information. They worked on a whole lot of different theories about what might have happened the day she went missing, but that's just yielded information about where she hasn't been rather than where she might have gone. They've checked morgues, they've checked hospitals, they've checked ocean liners leaving the city, but to no avail.
So I guess one of my main questions here is, did Dorothy still live at home?
Yes, she lived at home with her parents.
Okay.
Yeah, so she was 25, but was living with them.
So she wasn't a girl that would just, like, take off and go away on trips and stuff by herself normally?
At this time, her parents are like, that's not her. You know, she's just, like, this regular girl who likes hanging out with her friends and, you know, shopping and...
Reading some books and eating some candy.
Reading some books and eating some candy. She's, like, not out and about. And it's hard to understand why this 6-week delay in reporting, because that is so long.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't necessarily a lot of faith in the city police at the time, so the use of private detectives and Pinkertons, like people you paid for their labor to do this investigation, might have been a preferred tactic. And what happens next may give some clues about why the parents wanted to go in this direction. As soon as the news breaks, a man who owned what is described as a waterfront pawn shop on West Street came forward and said that just hours before the press conference, a young woman who appeared to be of a higher social class and looked like Dorothy Arnold had come into his shop and asked if he sold men's clothing. She said that she was going to a masquerade and wanted to wear it as a costume. The man said that she seemed nervous and wouldn't meet his gaze as they spoke, and during this exchange, he told her they didn't have men's clothing, but they did have men's shoes. Unfortunately, none of the shoes that he had on display were narrow enough for her foot, so he sent his brother upstairs to look at the stock they had up there. At this point, he says that the woman became nervous and asked if they had a phone up there. She didn't seem too calm until the brother came down and reported, like, we don't have your shoe size. He says that she then tried to pawn a watch, but he's not licensed for that kind of sale, and so he couldn't buy it from her. But before she left, he says that she asked about boats leaving for Europe, and he advised her that one left yesterday for Havana and one was leaving that day for France.
Huh. So did something, or I guess we're going to get to it, but sounds like something happened while she was out that made her want to, like, disguise herself or run away.
Right, so we have this, like, mystery that's happening. Like, you know, so he comes to the news and he's like, I saw her this day. Hearing this news, investigators are immediately springing to action, sending a message to the ship going to France, asking if there are any unaccompanied women on board. But alas, Dorothy is not on board. Not long after this, her father was sent a ransom letter from somebody else asking for a sum of money that he said was absurd. He believed that neither the man at the pawn shop or the writers of the note were telling the truth. After all, they'd only come forward a full 6 weeks after his daughter went missing.
Right. So obviously from the stuff that he's putting out into the press at this point.
Yeah. So, like, nobody had been contacting him beforehand, but the news comes out and suddenly you have all these people coming forward.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it would be absurd to think that just hours before the press conference, that's when Dorothy reappears and is trying to catch a boat somewhere or buy men's clothing. Right.
Right.
So I'm not going to tell Dorothy's story chronologically, but rather kind of keeping almost in order of how the information was gathered about her case at the time. So we're going to kind of go forward and back a little bit. But because over the next few months following the press conference, the press covered her story nearly every day, following her story with like such rabid intensity. It was a little much. They would just be running article after article about her. And on the one hand, that made things incredibly difficult for her family, but on the other, it did reveal some clues as they were going through their coverage, and clues that her family had worked to not reveal in that initial press conference.
Sounds interesting.
Dun, dun, dun.
Mm-hmm.
So Dorothy was born July 1st, 1884, to Francis Arnold and Mary Arnold. Dorothy, who was sometimes known as Dot to her family, was the second oldest child. Her brother John was 1 year older. Her brother Dan Hinckley, who is sometimes called D. Hinckley, was 4 years younger. And her sister Marjorie was 6 years younger. Their paternal grandfather was once the president of the Mercantile National Bank, and her father had gotten a degree at Harvard before getting his doctorate in Germany. He headed up a perfume import business, largely dealing in perfumes from Russia and France. And her uncle was Rufus Peckham, who was a United States Supreme Court justice. That meant that this family was considered reasonably wealthy, even by today's standards, and also well-connected. They lived largely on the Upper East Side of New York City, and Dorothy went to school at the Velton School for Girls, which was a private school where she would have been instructed on things like physics, astronomy, language, and art. She likely would have been there at the same time as sculptor Melvina Hoffman, as well as poet and artist Catherine Rhodes. So, like, it was the place to be.
It was fancy, and she was getting, like, sounds like a really progressive education for women then.
Yes. Yeah. Like, this school was known for sending its graduates on to, like, Wellesley, Vassar, Barnard, Bryn Mawr. And that's exactly what Dorothy did. She went to Bryn Mawr, a private women's college in Pennsylvania, where it seems that she studied Latin and French. So, like, She knew things. And it's just interesting. So, you know, very often when you think of this time period, even though, like, yes, women went to college, like, you wouldn't necessarily think socialites heading to college. But that's what they were doing. They were grooming these girls through, you know, private girls' schools and then sending them off to college. When Dorothy graduated in 1905, she returned back home to her family, and it's said she devoted a good amount of her time to reading. Largely, though, it seems that Dorothy kind of enjoyed the privileges of many other wealthy socialites, like, both then and now. In 1908, she went with her parents to Europe, and she summered with them at their summer house in York Harbor, Maine. Her father was her financial supporter, and he gave her a $100 allowance each month, which is roughly about $3,000 a month in today's money.
That's not a bad little allowance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, where's my allowance?
My parents never gave me an allowance like that.
Well, my kid's allowance is nowhere near $100 a month, let alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let alone the equivalent in today's money.
I know. Yeah. We don't do the allowance thing very much.
So unlike some other wealthy women, Dorothy was not particularly interested in activism work of any sort, nor was she interested in performing and theatrical productions or any other sort of hobbies along those lines, because these were questions that came up during the initial press release. Instead, it seemed like a good part of her energy just went to, like, visiting friends around the city.
So she really is, like, essentially, like, a socialite.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, like, a lot of visiting friends, eating chocolates, reading books, that kind of thing.
It's not a bad life.
No. The Thursday before she disappeared, she withdrew the remainder of her monthly allowance from her bank account. So it sounds like she spent through her money each month. So reports indicated that she withdrew $36. On Saturday, she had lunch with some friends from Bryn Mawr at Sherry's, which was a well-known restaurant on Fifth Avenue. Those friends would later say that nothing unusual happened to come up during their conversation. On Monday, December 12th, she got ready to head out to look for a dress. Some reports say it was for her sister's debutante ball. Elsewhere, they say a holiday dress. But news reports also include that she was getting ready to host 60 Bryn Mawr graduates for a tea party at her home on December 17th. In any case, her mother offered to go with her. The two were, according to her mother, quite close, so this would have been fairly typical of them to get together. But Dorothy turned her down.
So on one hand, she's acting strange because she's not going with her mom. But then on the other hand, she's not acting like she's going anywhere either because she's planning this party.
Yeah, she's planning a party. Invites have been sent out, all of that. In one recreation of their dialogue, it says that Dorothy refused this offer because her mother wasn't feeling well, so she was just looking out for her mom's health. But when Dorothy tells her mother that a friend she's supposed to meet has canceled, her mother offers again. And again, Dorothy tells her to stay home, but adds that if she finds anything at the shop, she'll let her mother know so she can come down and join her.
So she seems to want to go by herself.
Yes. I mean, that seems quite clear. Dorothy then kissed her mother goodbye, turned left to head towards Fifth Avenue, and was off for Park and Tilford's, the candy shop. Again, she arrived there around noon, which is something the women working at the store would later remark on. They knew Dorothy Arnold well, as she often stopped by their store, but they said that she would usually arrive between 4 p.m. and 6 p.m., so the fact that she came several hours earlier did seem unusual for them.
I always find it so weird when people have, like, these scheduled times of things, because I don't know about you, but my life is very random on times that I go to places.
I think my times are maybe random, but I'm also reassured that, like, when I roll into Chipotle, the Chipotle workers know my order.
What does that say, right?
I feel like it says some things, but... Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or once, like, you know, at Subway, like, my husband ordered the wrong... He, like, called in an order, and he ordered the wrong thing, and the lady, like, fixed our order for us because she knew I wouldn't want what he had ordered.
First off, that's hilarious. And secondly, that's, like, the power of a woman right there, to remember what somebody wants,
right?
You know?
Yeah. And so, like, they remembered when Dorothy would usually come in and get her candies, and then I kind of love Dorothy even more, like, going to get her candies on the regular,
right? At, like, a specific time. Yeah. It's pretty fun.
She then went to the bookstore Brentano's and purchased a book. The reason that the Arnold family, and we know this, is because her father later received bills for both of these purchases.
That's a really fun way of shopping, too.
I know, because I find it really interesting that Dorothy, yes, received an allowance that she seemed to spend through on the regular. And I would assume that the allowance would be used for things like the candies or the books. But, like, no, she was still sending those bills on to her dad.
That's so funny. It's like those must be, like, essentials that dad just pays for.
Right. And so it's estimated that based on what she withdrew from her bank and the expenditures at Sherry's the weekend before when she was having lunch with her friends, she had roughly $20 to $25 on her that day. Initially, one last person reports seeing Dorothy. Stepping out of the bookstore, Dorothy runs into a friend. The friend reports that she said, "You're looking well, Dorothy," to which Dorothy responded, "I'm feeling fine. I'm going to walk home through Central Park."
Was walking through Central Park something she did often?
Yeah, so her family says this was like a common thing for her to walk through the parks. That evening, though, Dorothy did not get home for dinner, which did cause some alarm, but her parents were not panicked because they said she frequently spent evenings and nights with one of her girlfriends. And here it's specified that she was not in the habit of staying with college friends, but with high school friends. I don't know why they needed to make that clear, but...
Maybe because were her college friends in Pennsylvania? Her high school friends would have been in New York?
She did have... college friends in New York City. So the friend she runs into outside the bookstore, that's a college friend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But, so I don't know why.
So that's a really weirdly specific thing that they were clarifying on.
Yeah. I think sometimes maybe some of the habits and understandings, particularly in this story, will come up in those, like, why did you specify that really random thing?
Yeah.
Right. The next day, when she was still not home, her family did check with her friends, and then this is when they realized that she might not be with them. And so her father went first to his lawyers and asked them to begin a systematic search for his daughter. Through them, they hired private investigators and the Pinkertons to handle this case. But just before Christmas, when no evidence indicating where Dorothy is was found, her father went to the deputy police commissioner and explained her case. That this stayed, like, completely under wraps, at least from the press, until late January is, like, simply astounding to me. You're talking to her friends. You've gone to the police, finally.
Right.
And no one is saying anything. By the time her father went to the press, though, he seemed pretty convinced that Dorothy had met with an act of violence. He first said it was to an act of providence and not by her own will that my child was lost, and will be an act of providence that will restore her to me. And then he goes on to say that he thinks it's possible that someone harmed her, that he didn't feel like she would worry him in this way on her own. And some of the reasons he believes this is, you know, it makes sense. First, Dorothy owned quite a bit of valuable jewelry, and he said this was still in her room, untouched. If she was planning on leaving, wouldn't she have taken it?
I guess possibly, unless it was like a very last minute decision.
Right? And then next is that apparently she really loved her new fur set of clothing.
I hate some of the reasons that they give for like women doing or not doing something.
Right.
It's like her purse, her fur, her, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is, she had a fur set,
oh my God,
which is comprised of a fur stole and a fur muff, but she had only taken the fur muff with her on that day. And it's thought if she was going to run away in winter, wouldn't she have brought both pieces with her?
That, oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the third is that she left her correspondence behind. All of her letters and writings were still at home.
Okay. But if somebody was in like a real
rush
situation where somebody was, they were afraid of somebody or they were having like a mental health issue or something like that, I don't think they'd be thinking about their fur and their jewelry and their letters.
Yeah. But these are the his rationale for why she couldn't have run away on her own is these things.
Okay.
Now, when we recently spoke about Beverly Sharpman's case from 1947, one of the things that happened is that people kept reporting to her mother that they had seen her somewhere, and this set Beverly's mom across the country time and again, like, looking for her daughter. This case is very similar in that most of the news coverage about Dorothy is really random people across the Northeast who think they've seen her. And I'm not saying this kind of reporting isn't good. Like, I really would hate for someone to hesitate in reporting a missing person, but report after report of Dorothy being seen came in, and none of those are playing out. So as soon as it's in the news, they're like, I saw her. She was on a ferry. I saw her. She was in a store.
Now, I have a hard time with this, too, because, like, I don't know for sure, because I wasn't around in 1911, but I don't feel like the photos would have been as clear or as, like, good as they are now. Like, when we're putting out photos, we're putting out multiple photos of a missing person. They're very clear most of the time, like, if we have those things. What are they putting out exactly of Dorothy?
Okay, so there are a few photos of her that are actually shared, but they're very...
They're going to be, like, black and white.
They're black and white.
And they're going to be reproduced in, what, a newspaper that's going to degrade the quality.
Exactly. So they're it's hard to really make out her features, etc. And to help alleviate that, and because they didn't have a drawing or a picture of her in what she was wearing, they actually drew, like, a little picture of Dorothy with, like, what she was wearing with, like, little arrows pointing out the individual pieces. And it's just, like, this little cartoon character, Dorothy, in the paper.
See? How can you recognize somebody from their cartoon selves?
It was cute, but...
cute, but not helpful?
It would not help me recognize Dorothy out and about, I don't think. But one thing that actually does happen from all this news coverage, this constant coverage, is that reporters start to uncover a bit more about what the Arnold family was keeping quiet about Dorothy's disappearance. First, it's revealed that Dorothy's great interest was in becoming a writer. So remember, they were like, oh, she just likes to stay home and read books. Like, no, she was actually staying home and writing stories. That summer, she'd written a 5,000-word romantic story called Poinsettia Flames for Cosmopolitan that she'd submitted for their review. It was rejected by them and another magazine. I see McClure's mentioned a lot in the coverage of her case, so it's safe to say that she was aiming for some pretty popular women's periodicals at the time. She'd also written some poetry that she called Lotus Leaves, but couldn't find a publication for that either.
There's none of her writing out there?
Yeah, not that I have seen. And it seems that her family really didn't support this goal of hers, which might be why they weren't talking about it. At least one of her brothers had made fun of her for her work and also for her rejections.
Oh, no.
And her sister thought it was possible that Dorothy had published something, but if she did, she couldn't remember where it might have been.
How does this make you feel as a writer?
Like, I was trying to think about this, and I was like, okay, well, you know, when I first was getting published, I am not sure that my family could have said where my pieces were, but they definitely knew when it happened, right? And my dad was probably telling random strangers on the street, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Dorothy's father, he admits that Dorothy wanted a career and that she had tried that through her writing only to experience rejection.
So he obviously doesn't think this is, like, a great career.
No. Like, I don't think that they took her very seriously about this. And then, like, so this leads to just days after the press conference, reporters follow two mysteries when it comes to Dorothy's case. The first is that Dorothy's mother, Mary, hasn't been seen. And when asked about her whereabouts, Dorothy's father and lawyers are really evasive.
How long hasn't she been?
It's been weeks.
Really?
Where's Dorothy's mom? Yeah.
Okay. That's weird.
Second is that a clerk at the post office reports that Dorothy had been getting mail sent to the post office through general delivery for at least several weeks. So it's kind of like having a post office box.
Right. But, so it's like a more anonymous way.
Yeah. So instead of coming into a post office box, it would just arrive at the mail center and you would go and pick up your mail.
But like stuff that mom and dad can't see.
Yes.
Yes.
So on December 12th, the day she disappeared, she'd been in to that post office around 2 p.m. and received a letter bearing foreign postage. He says that she tore open the envelope immediately and that it contained a single sheet of paper. Then she stepped aside to look at it. In one report, it was said she was in company of a man, and later it says she was with a group of well-dressed people. But regardless, she's getting mail secretly.
That seems very interesting.
Yes. And there are two explanations that are given about her receiving this mail at general delivery that really kind of take hold. The first is that she's done it because of the teasing she's received from her siblings about the writing and the rejections.
Well, I think this is a good idea then for her.
Right. That she could receive those in private without worrying about, you know, yet another family member making fun of her.
And not quitting entirely.
Exactly. And the second explanation is that she has a secret love. That this is something that people in her circle largely push back against. Her sister-in-law, who is married to her oldest brother, John, says, "Miss Arnold is a very pretty young woman. She was always happy, and I never heard that she had a love affair. Her disappearance is a mystery to us. We can't understand it. This was the first time she disappeared."
We'll be back in a moment.
Why do those things have to be separate? Why can't she be a very happy woman, but also having a love affair?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, what is going on with this family? Right. So there's this rumor that she's getting, like, secret messages from someone. And I admit her sister is, like, a bit convincing here. She never had a love affair. Her disappearance is a mystery, et cetera, et cetera. Except there's one issue. Most of the publications that she's submitting to were based in the United States. So if she's receiving mail with foreign posted on it, where is it coming from?
I'm not sure. Didn't she have, like, an Italian boyfriend, though?
Well, her parents very firmly said that was just a man in her acquaintance.
But he's still foreign.
He is.
There might be others.
In a foreign location.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Which is why, on January 28th, the Washington Post publishes a pretty eyebrow-raising piece. They claimed that they learned the police have stopped working on Dorothy's case and haven't been working on it for at least 10 days, which would have been around January 17th or 18th. Now, this would make sense because her father goes to the press on the 26th, something he viewed as a last resort. So is it possible that he did this because the police at least have already given up looking for Dorothy?
I think that makes sense.
And then furthermore, the reason that the Washington Post says the police have stopped looking for her is because they feel through their investigation that Dorothy may have been with a man who is now in Florence. The Italian.
The Italian.
Well, he's not Italian. He's just in Italy.
In Italy.
In Italy. Initial reports about this man are really vague. They said he's been there in Florence, Italy for 6 to 7 months and that he's from a well-known American family.
Okay.
The Washington Post includes that the private detectives have been keeping an eye on him while he was in Italy and had even intercepted his mail and read it before he received it.
So they think he's suspicious even before Dorothy goes missing?
No. So there's that 6-week gap between Dorothy going missing and, you know, the press getting a hold of this story. And so
In that time,
detectives were in Italy keeping their eye on this guy.
Okay.
So it's clear there are some suspicions.
Mm-hmm.
On January 28th, Dorothy's brother comes into New York on the Savoy, a French ship that had left Europe. John had worked for his father, and he said that he had gone to Europe for business reasons and had only just learned of his sister's disappearance a few days before.
Nobody wrote the guy a letter?
Yeah, he says, I didn't know my sister was missing.
Okay.
But on January 31st, this story changes. They admit that John had been in Florence and spoken with a man named George S. Griscom Jr. This is the man in Florence that his sister knew.
Mm.
Speaking mostly through their team of lawyers, the family says that Dorothy knew George, and they'd sent him a cablegram in Italy to see if he knew anything about her disappearance. He simply cabled back, no, nothing. While John wouldn't say exactly what happened when he went to Florence or why he went, he does say this as he's leaving his lawyer's office. I am sure my sister is dead. I have felt that she was dead all along, and now I'm sure of it. I've given up all hope of ever seeing my sister again.
Do we think John can be, like, covering up for George in some way?
I don't think he's covering up for George, but he is definitely lying. Because, like, this man legit said the day before, oh, hey, I just found out my sister was missing. And now he's saying, oh, I thought she was dead this entire time. You mean, like, in the last few days?
Right, and he'd been to Florence to talk to George.
Exactly.
Like, come on.
When he's asked why he thinks his sister is dead, he refuses to answer and says that he's turning that question over to his lawyer, Mr. Keith. Keith says, I'm not answering that either. But he does emphasize no scandal of any sort has played any part whatsoever in this case.
That sounds like it's obviously a scandal.
Yes. Like when there's that much protest, right?
Exactly.
Finally, it's revealed that Dorothy's mother had traveled with her son to Italy and was there with him on January 5th to talk to George at the Anglo-American Hotel in Florence. One of the lawyers, Frank Gavin, says that he isn't sure if Mary, the mom, spoke to George herself, but he does know that John had on at least 2 occasions. And it's revealed that while John came home, Mary stayed in Europe.
So that's where she is. But why would she be in Europe if her daughter's missing? Like, that, you know, you'd think you'd go back home and help.
Yeah, so like, you know, while, you know, they're giving this story, hey, you know, oh, John's just in Europe on business. But it's very clear that he and his mother went there specifically to talk to George.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, on February 1st, the lawyers reveal that Dorothy had a few pamphlets in her room for various ship lines, including the Cunard, White Star, Red Star, American, and Atlantic Transport. The news spurred a tourist agent who had a location next to the bookstore to come forward to say that on the day she went missing, Dorothy had actually stopped in and he'd given her information about various ship lines. It's hinted that the pamphlets in her room were from this tourism agency, but there's no indication that Dorothy went home that afternoon. So, like, she couldn't have picked up those pamphlets, run home, dropped them off, mm-hmm. and then disappeared. More importantly, though, it's revealed that the exchange between Dorothy's brother John and George did not go smoothly. After asking George a question and hearing his response while they were in Florence, John punched George in the face and then jumped on him, smacking him over and over. He asked for Dorothy's letters to George, and when George made a movement towards his pocket, John grabbed them.
Okay, so this could be the guy she's talking to, obviously.
Yeah, so it feels very much like when they're like, no, there's not a scandal. There's definitely a scandal.
There's a scandal.
Yeah. So who exactly is this George guy in question? George S. Grissom Jr. was a 40-year-old man who lived with his parents in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. They resided at a hotel, the Kenmar, instead of their own independent residence. George was described as a near constant companion of his father, George Sr., who was a merchant, and despite claims that Junior, as he liked to be called, was unemployed, records do indicate that he held various job titles throughout the years, including sales and as an engineer. It seems that in Pittsburgh circles, at least, they were well known, but I don't get the impression they had nearly the same wealth or connections as the Arnold family.
It's just, you know, that 40-year-old guy living at home, vacationing in Italy and...
with his parents.
Talking to a 25-year-old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. George is often described as a bachelor, which he was. Mm-hmm. He had been engaged, though, before to Carolyn Hayes, who was a wealthy member of the Pittsburgh elite. I am taking a small story detour here because, really, I read this and I can't not say it. So it's in my brain. It's going to be in your brain. This is my gift to you.
Sure.
In 1905, Carolyn, the woman George was engaged to, called off her wedding to George on the evening before their wedding at their rehearsal dinner because they got into a quarrel about her dogs.
Perfect.
4 years later, as she was set to marry her second husband, she didn't get married to George. There's a husband in between. And then she's a widow getting married to her second husband, the Reverend Samuel Craig. She chloroformed all of her dogs, killing them.
No.
Yes. She said that she had lost a good husband once through her dogs and never again would let dogs interfere with her happiness.
So the dogs are the reason of any marital unhappiness, so we must chloroform them?
Yes. All of her dogs. Apparently she had many dogs.
No. Yeah. She's a little bit nutty.
There's something going on there. But I will point out, she did say she lost a good husband once, so I guess her opinion of George was pretty high.
Okay, so I'm glad you got something sweet out of that.
I was really, really trying there. Anyway, so back to Dorothy and George. Yes, please. There are several reports of where Dorothy and George met. One is that she met him while she was in college, which with Bryn Mawr being in Pennsylvania makes sense. Mm-hmm. The second is that she met him while vacationing in Nantucket. Either way, it's clear that the two formed some sort of attachment to one another. And in the summer of 1910, her mother invited him to stay with them at their summer house in Maine. Apparently, this meeting did not go well. Her father was not a fan of George and basically said she should end her relationship or interest in him.
How would you feel, though, if your 24-year-old daughter brought home a 39-year-old man?
No. See? Like, no.
Dad was right.
Despite this, though, it's clear that the two still communicated with each other. Some of the letters left behind in her room were from George, and a family friend said it was clear from George's part that he was romantically interested in her, and based on the contents of the letters, it's clear that she was as well. So even though her family was adamant publicly from the start that there were no men involved with her romantically, it's clear also from the start that they considered this a possibility, which is why they sent the cablegram to him in Italy when they couldn't find Dorothy in New York, and why her brother and mother took off for Europe. At one point, her brother slipped up and said that Dorothy may have even sent a picture of herself, big romantic moves in the 1910s, to George, indicating that they had traced some of her involvement with this man.
So we're really covering up a lot of things.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, more rumors start swirling. The press finds out that she is in Washington, D.C. in late November, visiting a friend and want to know why she was there, particularly because she asked that her mail that she was getting sent general delivery be forwarded there. At one point, the press calls the friend she was staying with Josephine, but her name is actually Theodora Bates, who Dorothy knew from college. Theodora is hounded quite a bit by the press, but she describes her friend as popular, lighthearted, talented, and congenial. One of the rumors that is swirling is that Dorothy may have eloped with this man, George, to Europe. The press asks Theodora about it, and she says, Dorothy was popular with everyone, of course. Like all girls, she knew lots of nice men. But as to a romance and elopement, I don't believe in that theory. Anyway, if it has any foundation, I know nothing of it.
More denial.
Right. Like, I love how she's like, obviously this is not a thing that happened, but if it did, I don't know anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. In February The man himself, George, arrives in New York with his father and mother in tow. They come in on a Mediterranean cruiser out of Berlin. Now, to the New York press, he was an unknown. Given that he was from Pittsburgh and not part of the New York crowd, this was the first time that they had actually seen him. At only 5'6", he was described as being shorter than his father, but then one paper adds of his looks that he has an appearance of a cultivated Scotchman who has lived in England, or a cultivated Englishman who has spent much time across the border.
I'm trying to picture that now, and I can't.
Like, what does that even mean?
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Like, I don't feel like I know enough of, like, 1911.
That's so funny. I wish I could, like, just recognize that somebody has lived somewhere.
Right. But they did say, and this is something I do understand, which is he has a soft and easy voice.
Everybody likes that.
The press even goes so far to ask the men who were on the boat with him from Europe what they thought of him. They said that he was often with his father and that he was unusually well-informed and read a lot of worthwhile books.
I'm judging his reading material.
Yeah. When George gets to New York, one of the first things he says as he begins talking to reporters is that he has come back to the United States because he has promised her mother, when he saw her in Italy, certain things. And when asked what those promises were, he wouldn't answer.
Sounds suspicious.
Everyone's suspicious. It's like a crowd of suspicious people. No scandal.
So many scandals. Nothing but scandals. Scandals on top of scandals.
Yep. When they ask him about his exchange with Dorothy's brother, John, at the Anglo-American Hotel in Florence, he says basically the 1911 version of what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Nice.
He does add, though, that John did take a letter from Dorothy to him that was dated November 27th. He says that he received this letter in Florence after she went missing. He also adds that he last saw Dorothy on November 3rd, 1910, in New York City, which was 2 days before he left for Italy. And then he drops a bit of information that I don't know if he intended to, which is that he saw her in Boston, he says, in August, but he couldn't speak more about this. And so reporters now have a lead in a direction they hadn't necessarily explored too much.
There's so much these people can't say.
Yeah, he's a little bit chatty, this George guy. He'll say something and be like, but I can't talk about it. While reporters are getting ready to figure out why he saw her in Boston and what he was talking about, George takes off with his parents to Atlantic City. This seems kind of questionable, but I don't think that the family quite realized what kind of media coverage they were facing when they returned to the States, and they were likely trying to just get some distance from it. Even in Atlantic City, though, the press was relentless, so the family basically rarely left their hotel rooms. Once there, though, George starts saying that as soon as Dorothy is found, he wants to marry her. In later coverage of the story, it gets repeated that they were secretly engaged, but, like, the contemporary newspaper accounts make it clear that he is saying that they weren't engaged, that her family objected, but he wanted to be, even though there's, like, nothing official.
So is her family saying there's no relationship? He's saying that he'll marry her as soon as she comes back. Her brother's saying she's dead.
Yes, that's, like, where we are
okay.
with this. Her family really is not thrilled that he's saying this, but they're even more unhappy when journalists uncover what actually happened in Boston. Apparently, Theodora Bates, you know, of the if something is between them, then I don't know, fame. Dorothy's friend. So she was in Maine that summer of 1910 to stay with Dorothy. Apparently, Theodora was there for about 2 weeks before the pair said that they wanted to go to Boston to see one of their friends, Helen Kempton, from college. Reporters hadn't spoken to Helen Kempton before, so they asked her about Dorothy and Theodora's visit. She said that she saw Dorothy on the 24th of September and that Dorothy had been staying with Theodora. When asked about George, Helen said, "This talk of an engagement between Dorothy and Mr. Grissom at the present time is all nonsense anyway. I knew her very well in college, and there has not been an engagement between them for a year and a half. Even then, there were other men I thought it more likely she would marry." It's like quite the put down.
Yeah.
Like, not that guy.
Not him.
Despite what Helen said, though, reporters were able to uncover that Dorothy and Theodora arrived in Boston on September 19th. Apparently, they thought they would be able to get a room in the Bryn Mawr section of the university club, but it was full. George had arrived in Boston on September 16th, and he says that he just happened to be there on business, and he was checked in at the Hotel Essex.
So these people are, like, all over the place. They obviously don't have to work.
Oh, yeah.
The money is just supply. They're just everywhere all the time.
Yeah. I mean, her father, like, clearly works at his import business, and her brothers work there, and, like, George is just, like, traveling around with his parents.
Dorothy kind of is.
Dorothy is, too.
Traveling around, too. Yeah.
Yeah. So that this they just happen to be there on business at the same time Dorothy and Theodora are there. Like, please.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly because it's George who's able to secure a room for Dorothy and Theodora at the Hotel Lenox. So they're not in the same hotel, but they're in the same city together.
Yeah.
When reporters bring this information to Helen, she is shocked. She thought Dorothy had only just arrived on the 24th, when in reality, she'd been in town for days. Poor Helen.
Yeah.
Theodora says that she and Dorothy were together for much of the time they were in Boston, but that Dorothy did have several evenings out with George, including out to a country club. And then, on September 23rd, Dorothy went to the Collateral Loan Company, essentially a fancy pawn shop, and pawned her gold watch and chain, two diamond rings, and two bracelets. The estimated value for these was $500, so roughly $15,000 to $16,000 worth of jewelry in today's money. She was able to get $60 for it, or roughly $2,000. She used her home address and her real name to complete this transaction.
So not all of her jewelry was at home then?
Yeah, so her father saying, oh, her jewelry is accounted for. Well, obviously not, sir. Mm-mm. The next day, so September 24th, both Dorothy and George checked out of their respective hotels. And if you remember, this is when Helen said she saw Dorothy, and that's when she thought she arrived in town.
Mm-hmm.
From there, Dorothy went to Nantucket for a few days, and it's really unclear where George went. When the news breaks in the papers about this jewelry situation and that their daughter had been in Boston, this is news to her family. Likely thought she had just been in Boston visiting her friend and not spending time with George and pawning her jewelry. The family went to Boston and were able to secure her jewelry.
That became a priority?
Yeah, well, I think they were like, what is this? Our daughter was in Boston pawning her jewelry. So it might be like they went to like
maybe just check up on it.
Yeah. Rumors began swirling that Dorothy needed that money for an abortion. They couldn't actually use the word abortion in the papers, so the newspapers write, now another hypothesis is that Dorothy left home for the purpose of undergoing an operation and died under it.
This sounds like the most likely thing.
It sounds very plausible that this was what was happening. It also becomes clear that the family had withheld a lot of information. While her trip to Boston to see George was likely new to them, a clerk came forward and said that around Thanksgiving, detectives arrived and started searching for marriage records in her name. He said they looked not just at recent records, but had been looking at records from the previous year. He claimed he remembered it because the task was so tedious and a bit of an undertaking. Now, if you remember, around this time in November, Dorothy was apparently in Washington, D.C., and some reports claim that she had gone missing during that time frame. The family brushed off this man's claim, but if true, it would seem that they were worried she had secretly married someone, perhaps George, without their knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
This is likely hard for her family to handle, the idea that their daughter is rumored to have had an abortion or to have gotten secretly married, and so they each kind of lean into their own theories. In late February, her mother attends a suffrage meeting where she hears one of the speakers begin talking about her daughter. The speaker's theory is that Dorothy was kidnapped and taken to a disorderly house where she was being held against her will.
So what's a disorderly house?
It would be basically another contemporary word for it would have been brothel. But, like, basically what she's saying is sex trafficking.
Okay. Yeah, because she's kidnapped into this. This is not sex work.
This is trafficking of her into it. And this is like a theory that becomes her mom's main theory at the time.
So mom is okay with this theory.
I think she feels that is somehow better than the secret marriage abortion theories.
Okay.
It's also around this time that her father starts talking about her being dead. He'd floated this idea before, and certainly her brother had said it, but he really leans into his own theory that Dorothy was attacked in broad daylight, perhaps in Central Park, and that her body is at the bottom of one of the lakes or ponds in the park.
That's oddly specific.
Yes. I don't know why this became his obsession, but
is that like how he wanted it to go down? Like, quick and just, like, done?
Maybe. right? There's like this explanation. But investigators really rejected this idea almost from the start. They said that there was ice in the water in Central Park when she went missing. The average temperatures in the days leading up to her disappearance were in the lower 20s, and skaters were observed skating there on water on December 13th.
There's no way they're dumping her into a pond.
Yeah, it seems very far-fetched, but on March 18th, just to sort of put those rumors to rest, investigators dragged the lakes and ponds of Central Park looking for her body, with, of course, no success. Mm-hmm. By June of 1911, so several months later, her brother gets married to Mildred Culver, who is described as a friend of Dorothy's. A few days later, Dorothy's parents and her sister leave for Italy, and newspapers start saying that they've gone to Italy to look for Dorothy. Those reports so enraged the parents that they speak to the Berlin correspondent of the New York Times and tell them they wanted to make it clear that this is not the case and that Dorothy has no reason at all to be on that side of the Atlantic.
I feel like the parents are standing in the way of like anyone solving this.
Yeah. Like, I feel like this probably wouldn't have been necessarily too much of a mystery if... I mean, I love that they hire, like, all these, like, detectives, and then, like, the newspapers are like, we found out other information.
Right.
Right? Unless that's information her parents actually knew and just didn't want public.
Right. They seem to be covering up a whole lot.
As time passes, when women of means go missing, Dorothy Arnold's name is brought up and the reporting of their cases. So it'll be, like, the woman's name, and it'll say, another Dorothy Arnold, ? We've seen that before, particularly when we talked about Mary Shotwell Little, who went missing from Atlanta in 1965. Like, just every case that came up after, they kept on mentioning Mary Shotwell Little's name. The same thing with Dorothy Arnold. And the theories of what happened to her don't stop either. There's people who claim they've seen her, there's people who claim they are her, and there's people who claim that they saw something terrible happen to her. The most solidly pursued one of these stories came out in 1916 with an arrest of a man named Edward Glenorris. He's basically a low-level gangster. He says that he got word from an associate, Little Louis Benoit, that he was wanted for a job.
What kind of job?
He showed up at this job, and he meets with him and a man he describes as a rich guy. He says they go to a big house where a man opens the door. Inside is a woman he says looks drugged who's laying on the couch, and it's his job to help carry her to a limo and take her out to West Point. This is like a really weird story to me. Like, why do you need all the men in the world to carry this one woman?
Hiring two men, right?
To like
Edward and Little Louis to come and carry her out
to the car. But he says that once he's done that, he leaves and he gets a call the next day saying that he needs to come back out because she's dead.
Okay.
He says, that's not part of the job that I was hired for. And they're like, you got to come and do it. So he goes out anyway and helps tear up the concrete in the cellar of this big house and buries her there.
Do we know whose house it is?
So we don't necessarily, but like detectives say that they follow up on this because in their estimation, there is only one house that matches the description of what he said. And they dig up the basement in a spot that they say looks promising, but don't find anything. Her father says that he doesn't believe the story either. Like at this point, so it's now been like 6 years.
Dad doesn't believe anything.
No. I mean, he still is
sticking with the pond.
When her father dies in 1922, he divides up his fortune. And his fortune is like it amounts to what would be about $10 million today. His residence goes to his wife. His stock and personal belongings goes to his sons. The residue of the estate is held in a trust with the income going to both his wife and his daughter. And he says he leaves nothing for Dorothy, satisfied at this point that his daughter must be dead.
Is that his words? The satisfied that she must be dead?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, you know, at this point, it's now been 12 years since her disappearance.
Okay.
And that's Dorothy's story.
So what do you think happened to Dorothy?
That's a good question. I mean, you're right that, like, could she potentially have gone and got an abortion? That seems like a plausible explanation. There were some, like, theories at the time that she had also committed suicide by jumping off the bow of an ocean liner. Mm-hmm. There was just, like, so many different ideas of who it could be. Like, at one point, they said a veiled woman was visiting George in Italy, and, like, that just turned out to be, like, her mom.
Okay.
Like, incognito.
Yeah. So, I mean, even if, so, like, say these gangster guys are right that they were hired to carry this girl around, could that even be, like, the result of an abortion gone wrong?
It could be, yeah. So, basically, to get an abortion at this time, like, you would have gone to basically found someone who would provide it right. for you. And those were often incredibly unsafe, often unsanitary conditions. So, yeah, so it's possible that, like, that's what happened.
Right, and it would be in, like, a private residence, and she probably would be highly drugged, and there is a chance she would die from that after.
Exactly.
She obviously didn't just disappear with George, because George is still here.
Yeah, so, and George, you know, just continued out the rest of his life, like, kept traveling. I don't think he ever married. But, yeah, I mean, I guess, like, what I, like, wish happened to Dorothy is that she was just, like, peace out, family. Like, I can't with you anymore. And, like, went and, like, wrote her little heart out somewhere.
Went to a different country and maybe fell in love with a man there who supports her writing and doesn't mind if she has dogs.
The poor dogs in this story. So, yeah, so that's what I wish happened is that, like, Dorothy was like, hey, I want a writing career. I mean, that's what, like, obviously, because as a writer, that would be my dream for her. Do I think that's what really happened? I don't know. I think something obviously happened to her, but I don't know specifically what.
We're now going to listen to Amy's poem, Inamorato, read by Sharon Lawrence. Sharon may be best known for her recurring roles in TV series such as Joe Pickett, On Becoming a God in Central Florida, Home Before Dark, Shameless, The Ranch, Grey's Anatomy, and NYPD Blue, or her film work including The Lost Husband of Mind and Music and Middle of Nowhere. She is also an accomplished stage actress appearing in plays such as A Kid Like Jake, The Mystery of Love and Sex, A Song at Twilight, Orson's Shadow, Love, Loss, and What I Wore, Tongue of a Bird, and her last Broadway appearance was as Velma Kelly in Chicago.
Inamorato. Dorothy Harriet Camille Arnold, 27, missing since December 12, 1910, from New York, New York. What is meant by a blue serge suit with its buttons neatly fastened, the placement of perfume at your wrists, its scent crushed from petals, and fixed with the essence derived from beavers, whose small deaths are part of the process. What is meant by your walk along sidewalks, crimsoned with ice, where chocolates are bought, in a shop whose sugar plums glazed, behind windows pockmarked with small fingerprints, or your bookstore stop, where sun electric dust motes drifted past? Or what can be said about an earlier secret weekend, wandering the streets of Baltimore with a lover of the quietest scents? Or the post office box swollen with the tattered envelope sent from abroad, nestled against crisp projections? Is it the hat that holds the greatest significance? The one with gray silk roses? Or that someone showed you how it is done, slipped off the bow of an ocean liner into the star-clustered sea.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.